Our featured BBB Wise Giving Alliance accredited charity seal holders for this episode are OneSight, Oxfam America, Pacific Crest Trail Association. To find out more about these and other BBB Wise Giving Alliance accredited charities, go to give.org.
You're listening to the Heart of Giving podcast with Art Taylor, powered by bbbgive.org. Here we explore the motivations that form the basis of giving and service. We inspire generosity and celebrate the transformative effects that giving and service have on the human spirit and on community. The conversations featured on the podcast also uncover giving strategies that educate and provide tools to help listeners make impactful gifts of both their time and money. We hope you enjoy this episode.
This is the Heart of Giving podcast, powered by bbbgive.org. Give.org is the nation's standards-based charity evaluator, and it's your one-stop source for information on giving and reports on the most asked about charities. I'm Art Taylor. Today, our episode will cover an interview of me, actually, by Tina Beattie, the Chief Marketing Officer at the Society for Human Resources Management. I was interviewed by Tina at a conference hosted by SHRM at the Microsoft Mountain View campus in California. And the topic of this conference was the AI plus HI connection, AI being artificial intelligence, of course, and HI being human intelligence. And the concept of this conference was that combining the two, we could do a lot more in business, society, nonprofit work, and other engagements that we have as human beings. Well, Tina asked me if I would agree to be interviewed about a project that we're working on at the BBB Wise Giving Alliance, which takes advantage of large language models to help people make better giving decisions. And I agreed to do that. So what you're going to hear is me answering questions related to that, such as, how did Give.org, a trust-based organization, decide to venture into AI and large language models? How did we get the board and employees to get on board, so to speak, with the AI project? What were some of the key ethical considerations in building this tool? And what advice would I give others looking to make the case for AI projects in their organizations? So I think you'll find this to be helpful, particularly if you are contemplating engaging in an AI project in your organization, based on our experience at the BBB Wise Giving Alliance.
Thank you, Tina. It's great to be here with you, especially.
So let's kick it off with just that idea of building a large language model. But before we get into the specifics of it, given the mission of Give.org, you guys are rooted in trust. You help donors every single day find a charity that they can trust. And so how did you go from a trust-based organization to leaping into the world of AI and large language models?
Well, actually, you're part of that story. So back in 2015, I was thinking about our organization and the success we were having, but still feeling pretty uneasy about what its next chapters would be. And so we found out about these people at this great organization out here called the Institute for the Future. I happen to serve on the board of that now. Didn't then. But the Institute gave us a whole host of ideas to think about understanding what was coming. And so Tina and her team led us through a strategic planning process And one of the outcomes of that was that we should be more innovative. We should be more free to try things and fail and not worry about the consequences so much. And one of the things we came up with was to look at the strengths that we have as an organization. So one of the strengths was this guy named Bennett Weiner. Bennett Weiner had been in our organization for about 25 years to that point. And so we went to Bennett, who knows more about charity accountability and the work we do than anybody in the world, literally. And so we were thinking about the future and technology, and we were saying to ourselves, how great would it be if we could create an Ask Bennett, this digital avatar, so that whenever people wanted to know something about a charity, they could just simply ask Bennett, this tool, right? We could just fill it with everything that Bennett knew, and this thing could spit it out on demand. Well, we thought about it, but there was no way to do it back then. So Tina, I'm looking at ChatGPT about a year and a half ago, and I'm saying, oh, we might be able to do this. So I immediately go to a board meeting and I put in a prompt. And the prompt is, give me an impact report on the American Red Cross. And our board is sitting there dumbfounded by what comes up on the screen. All this great information about the American Red Cross. About 20% of it was wrong. And then we put in another prompt, which was, tell me about Kelly Bevis. Now, Kelly Bevis is one of our employees. And it was totally wrong. It had information about Kelly that could not be used at all. So that one little experiment set us on a course to try to build a tool, but also let us know that there were some things that we needed to make sure we didn't do. And the didn't do part is really key for us because we are an ethics organization. We want people to support charities that they can trust. And so to make sure we did that, our language model had to have curated information, information that we vetted, information that we believed in, information that we would stand behind. And so we're building this tool with just that information. Over time, we're going to add other pieces of information from other curated sources.
How do you pick what sources you're going to trust as much as your data?
Right. So we have to go to organizations that we know we can trust. We start with organizations that, for instance, curate information about boards. Board Source might be a great source for that. Other organizations that have financial information on charity that we know we can trust. So we're looking to places like the Indiana University, where they are gathering information about how people give to charities. So sources of data that we can pretty much trust is going to be pretty accurate and use that to train this language model so that we can move forward. So that was one of the key tenets, Tina, to make sure that we can do everything possible to make sure that the hallucinations aren't so bad that they aren't at least plausible.
And so had you prepped your board, because I wonder if a lot of people are sitting here and going, ooh, that's a risk, right? To use ChatGPT or to even a live demonstration in front of your board, knowing that you wanted them to approve the idea of you guys investing time and money to build something custom or proprietary to you guys. What did you kind of do to soft sound that to some of your board members before you walked into that meeting? And how could folks maybe learn of what worked and what didn't for you guys?
So we were a little ahead of the curve because we did that work years ago. The board kind of anticipated that I'm kind of a wacky guy, that I do that kind of thing, that I bring weird ideas to them. Sometimes they go somewhere, sometimes they don't. And they sort of love me now about that. They love that about me. But we also manage the organization pretty well. We don't just throw money away. We do small projects. And this is something that I would highly recommend to you. We do small projects, test them. If they work, we expand it. If not, then we keep it small until it gets better. So that's the secret to that. But we had to do this work beforehand. The board had to be prepped with years of understanding the importance of our being an innovative organization, so that when I bring these weird ideas to them, they're not all, you know, ready to call an executive session and get rid of me.
It's good you knew that was not going to happen, but that takes a lot of work, right, to warm up the board to that new idea, especially something that is as flashy or sensational as ChatGPT or large language models. And unfortunately, right now in the media cycle, we're seeing when it can go bad, right? Google and Gemini are dealing with that. And so I'm sure for any organization, small, mid, or large organizations, you fear that same risk, right? How do we move forward and try to build something but mitigate for what could happen? So it sounds like you really kind of set that stage over a number of years for your board to be ready for that. So then it moves into, okay, the board let you leave that meeting with a thumbs up. And so now you move into the idea of how do we do this? Is it within ChatGPT? Is it other tools? What use cases did you look at? So for folks who are just in the to-do list of look into it, where did you guys start and how could you help guide the folks here today?
Great question. You need a trusted partner, because none of us knew anything about this. All we knew was what the outputs were going to be, you know. So we went to a trusted partner, back to the Institute, where they knew of people who were working on large language models and generative AI projects. And we came across a person who could help us think through our idea. We had the idea. Now they had to tell us what it would take to actually make it work, what some of the challenges would be to create something that would produce information based on trusted data, some of the issues that we would encounter actually getting employees to agree, which some of you have also experienced or maybe will experience, and we can talk about some of that. But you need a trusted partner who is willing to understand your organization, what its challenges are, and actually what you want to experience. I mean, the first month and a half of conversations were less about what technology solution do you want to use and more about our organization, its culture, our brand. What is it that we want to put out into the world and how do we want people to respond to us? Those questions had to be dealt with first before we even got into questions around technology. So you need a trusted technology partner. I can't stress that enough. And then from there, you can go forward and begin building a project.
When did the ethics question, kind of what appetite for risk and how do you embody ethics, come up in those conversations with the Institute for the Future?
Great question again. So for us, we start the question of ethics with the human-centered aspect of the project. So if there was a continuum, on one end of the continuum, there would be complete human-centered, right? On the other end of the continuum would be profit-centered. And no project is going to be totally one or the other. For instance, if you're really interested in making sure that the data is accurate, then that's going to put you probably more on the human continuum side. If you're more interested in how you're going to pay for it, that might put you more on the economic side, right? If you're interested in making sure that people whose information was used gets attribution and not take their information, that's going to put you more on the human side, but probably less on the economic side because you may have to compensate those people for allowing you to use their information. So there are factors that go into where you will land on that continuum from an ethical standpoint. But we are predominantly a human-centered organization. Our first project, Tina, had little to do with our ability to generate revenue. It had everything to do with how can we help people give to organizations more effectively. And so this tool we created is not about how we can be more efficient as an organization. The work that our people do is evaluating charities. We're not building a tool to help them with that. What we're building a tool for is to help people better access our data and make decisions, and that's all free.
Was that a decision point, though, at the beginning to say we want to dabble in AI and language models? Because you could have gone the efficiency route and said, all right, our team is, I mean, that's a highly manual review of all of that data, right?
Yes,
in order for your members to trust you.
Right.
So you could have looked for efficiency in your staff, but you guys decided to actually do it for your external audiences. Was that an active decision point, or did you just kind of evolve and get there?
No, it was very active, because like you're going to face, there are going to be people in your organization who are very skeptical about this technology and concerned about whether it's going to take their job or augment their job. Now, they kind of know me, and I'm not really out to get people. I love who I work with, and I don't want to see them leave, and they don't leave. So they kind of trust that we're not trying to do anything like that. But there were lots of people concerned about how this technology could affect our brand, for instance, and they weren't necessarily down with the use of this so quickly. And the way we were able to get over it was to say, well, wait a minute. We have a mission of helping people make informed giving decisions. We kind of have an obligation to see what we can do here to make them do that more efficiently, right? And so that kind of got them into wanting to be supportive. But the most important thing to get employees in, is to get them engaged in building it. So we had a whole employee group that focused on building this. And at some point, every person in our organization had an opportunity to weigh in and make sure that their questions got answered. And the tool that we're building is reflective of as much of that as possible.
And now it's time for our giving tips segment with Bennett Weiner, one of the world's most renowned experts on charity accountability and the COO of the BBB Wise Giving Alliance.
Today, I'd like to talk about some of the fundamental differences in government regulations versus voluntary standards. And in terms of charities, when we're talking about required regulations for them, we're referring to things such as, for example, the law requires charities to file certain information, such as the IRS Form 90 with the IRS on an annual basis if revenue is above a certain amount. And the law also requires charities to register with various state government agencies if they're going to be soliciting. And of course, the law requires charities not to be engaged in fraudulent activities, among other things. So, those are just examples of some requirements on the regulatory side. But we're talking about voluntary standards. These are practices that charities are encouraged to follow that really aren't about the letter of the law, but about recommendations that are thought to be best practices in terms of organizations' governance, finances, appeal content, donor privacy, among other matters. And these are the things that we ask charities to follow in order to be an accredited charity and meet those 20 standards. While some of these recommendations that we have may overlap with legal requirements, the standards themselves really are voluntary, and in many instances call for things that really go beyond what the law requires. So really, one complies with regulations because the law requires it. But in contrast, one either meets or does not meet a standard if one chooses to follow it. And that is the basic distinction between what we do and what government agencies do in reporting on charitable organizations.
What were some of the biggest hurdles, and then how did you overcome those hurdles when it came to the employee population, especially the advocates, but the dissenters that you had to bring along on the journey? What did you notice and how did you convert them?
Well, the dissenters were people who didn't believe that a machine could actually produce information that people could use. You know, they were people who are so strictly embedded in empiricism that they just couldn't understand how something that wouldn't automatically produce the same result every time you asked it could be useful to people. So we had to explain to them that this isn't a fact machine. This isn't a machine that's just going to produce facts. That's not what we want it for. Google still has a great search function for that. We have a search function on our website, and anybody can find facts through search. But what we explained to them was what people need to do is think differently about their giving. We have a crisis right now among the donating public. We've gone from 66% of families giving to charities down to 49.5% over about a 20-year stretch. We've got to do things differently to engage donors with charitable organizations. And some of that, I think, is just giving people the freedom to explore information that they may not know about charitable organizations and how to give effectively and how to support causes that matter to them. And that was the hope with this particular project.
So obviously you guys know a lot about your audience, and that helped you start to build this tool. How much market research did you do, whether informal or formal? Did you really rely on what you thought you knew of the audience, or did you purposely set aside time and funding to go out and ask your external audience?
So we've been doing what we call donor trust reports for the last 6 years. Every year we do a large survey of the donating public to understand their needs and aspirations and the extent to which they actually trust the charities that they support. So we have a lot of data on where our people are, where the public is. And there's other data that we use to help us understand where the donating public is. And that data was taken into account. In fact, that data is also going to be training the large language model. So we are fortunate in that way. Again, some of where we are today and why we were able to jump on this so quickly, as you can see, goes back to a lot of things that we already had in place. And I would say for you, you probably have a lot of things in place already that you might want to also use to help make a case for why you're ready for projects like this.
What type of documentation? How would you suggest someone sitting here today kind of culls through their thoughts, maybe files, and starts to build that business case to maybe bring to their boss or to their board?
Okay. So the first thing is you got to get people thinking about using it, because what you document, Tina, is going to depend on what your use cases are. And we were just having some chat here at lunch about what projects should organizations use. And my feeling is you start with people by asking them, what could we do to make your job more effective? Or what could we do to take some of the drudgery out of your job? What could we do to help you make your job more productive, right? And then let them tell you, well, if we could eliminate this part, if I could just add on to that. Don't even talk about generative AI or a chatbot. Just talk about how they would like to be enhanced, essentially. And from there, you can begin thinking about tools that might actually enhance that. And if you aggregate that over a large segment of a department, you're going to come up with some pretty good ideas for some projects. So then the documentation gets built around that.
Were there some leadership learnings that you had during this process? I mean, each project is so different, right?
Yeah.
And there is always that opportunity to look back and go, ooh, ran into the brick wall there. Is there anything that you would offer here you would do it differently if you were starting now?
One thing we're a little hung up on, we hit a snag recently, so we're part of the Better Business Bureau system. We're a separate organization, but local Better Business Bureaus do charity reporting in their local communities. And their information is also valuable for us to include in our model, right? And so some of the challenges we're having right now is just aggregating that data in such a way that we could input it. So if I had more foresight, we would have done that work a long time ago. We would have developed more robust platforms for aggregating that data so that we could have input that into a system. But what I'm saying to you is you're going to hit that. There's going to be something that you're going to want to do, and you're not going to have everything laid out the way you want. So, you know, you add on a few more months to your timeline when you hit that snag. And don't feel like you can't just play with this technology. Right now, we have the great luxury, I think, of being wrong. In 5 years, we won't have that luxury. Right now, you can do things and say, oops, that didn't work. And everybody will say, haha, well, you know, it's just getting started. It'll get better. Take advantage of that. You know, don't just wait until you think everything is perfect. And now you have a much bigger burden to overcome when something does go wrong. Get into it now. Play with it. Laugh when it doesn't work out. I did a funny thing recently. So I have this podcast called The Heart of Giving Podcast. You should listen to it. It's great. And so to promote this podcast, I created on this program called HeyGen. HeyGen, a digital avatar. And what I did was gave it a script, and then I had a conversation with it, and we spiced the conversation together to create a video where it appeared that I was having this conversation with my digital twin. And so I would say, hi, I'm Art Taylor, the host of the Heart of Giving podcast. And the thing said, no, I'm Art Taylor. You're the digital copy. And I said, well, wait a minute. I'm really Art. You're the digital twin. He says, well, and we have this conversation back and forth. It's hilarious. I put it out on LinkedIn, got a lot of response. Have fun with it. You know, I got a lot of people coming to me and saying, that was so creative. That was fun. And I told them, yes, this isn't serious. This is just something to have fun with. But you can do the same thing. You know, lighten up your brand a little bit. Give people something different to think about. And I think that'll also take some of the heat off of the seriousness of this.
I love the empowering nature of looking at this technology through that full continuum, right? Have fun with it. Roll with it. When it doesn't go well, acknowledge it and move on. But then, you know, even as we heard from Johnny this morning, right, you can get on to a Zoom call and it's a deep fake and now you're wiring $25 million away. So there is all sides of the technology. So I think there is probably something about being transparent, right, in this is what we've produced and here is the outcome of it, right? So I'm sure for your LinkedIn post, you were very transparent to say you knew what you were doing and you did it on purpose. Now here, let's have some fun with it, right? That context really matters.
Absolutely. And that's what you should say. Don't. So the first one I put out was just me talking, a digital twin of me talking about something. And I put in there, this is my digital twin. And people really didn't know right away that it was. Only a few people reached out to me and said, was that AI? And I said, yeah, it was. And then, you know, but I put that in the description. But, you know, so there are going to be people who don't quite get that, but you have fun with that. Lean into it, not away from it, is kind of how I feel. Now, unless you're like the government or something where everything, the CIA, where everything has to be serious and buttoned down, that's a different story. But I'm a charitable organization. People should love the charity work that they're doing. They should lean into it and have fun with it and use these tools to get the word out about the important work that they're doing.
Yeah, it's another communication tool, absolutely, right? So there's some efficiency to it. There's some communications to it. And then there's some testing because you don't know where this is headed. So for that unknown part of it, because I wonder if this is a question that folks have, because the idea of having fun and even lightening up your brand, engaging your audience, we can all get behind. But the question remains, how much is this going to cost, right? So I don't know how much you can share with us here since you guys are in the midst of building something, but is this something that you need to get a huge investment in doing? Is it just bootstrap it? Kind of what was your financial POV coming into this?
Okay, so I'm sure our budget is smaller than anybody's in here. But I'll just give you an order of magnitude. It was about maybe 0.25% of our budget to do this. So it's not significant. It was enough that we felt it, but it wasn't such that we're going to waste a lot of money if it doesn't work. So for me, you can do these projects pretty inexpensively, I think, especially if you start with something that you believe is important, but is also something that starts out small. You don't have to spend a whole lot of money doing it, but you do need to get the right partner.
Did you guys look into multiple partners, or did you know, considering the work you had done previously, that you were going to go with the Institute of the Future? Did you investigate a couple other partners?
We didn't. We didn't, because I wanted to move quickly, and that may have been a mistake, because I know that there are larger organizations like Microsoft, for instance, who are saying, we want to partner with people and you should do that, you know. So that's great. But I was anxious to get going. I knew the pricing was right, and I knew the individual was capable. I knew the firm was capable of delivering. So I just went with that. And if we were spending more money, then I probably would say, wait a minute, we need to do, you know, a deeper thing. We just recently upgraded our CRM, and I had a much longer process for, you know, for that, because that was a lot more money.
And there's not as much fun in that as there is AI.
I had zero to do with
that. We've all been there. Well, thank you, Art. I appreciate all of your insights, sharing how you looked at trust and empowerment and the continuum of the decision making for your AI tool. We all look forward to seeing it as you roll it out to market.
Great. Thank you, Tina.
I want to thank the Society for Human Resources Management for conducting this conference. It was a very important conference, I think, because I believe human resource professionals will have a key role in deciding whether these tools are used to enhance humans or to replace humans, or where organizations will actually end on that continuum. I want to also thank Tina Beatty for allowing me to participate in the conference. And it was so great to get to know so many HR professionals who care about these particular issues. Now, for all of you who are listening to our podcast for the first time, I want to thank you for listening. And for those of you who have been continued listeners, I want to thank you too. But I hope that more of you will subscribe to our show. You can find us on all major podcast platforms. If you want to support the podcast, you can do so by going to give.org. And I can assure you that your contribution will be put to great use.
You've just listened to the Heart of Giving podcast with Art Taylor. Be sure to tune in next time for a brand new episode. To listen to our other interviews, visit heartgiving.podbean.com. That's heartgiving.podbean.com. Subscribe to our show on major podcast platforms. The thoughts and opinions expressed on this podcast are the views and opinions of the guests, not those of the BBB Wise Giving Alliance or program affiliates. This podcast is for information and educational purposes only and is copyrighted with all rights reserved. This podcast is protected by Podbean's terms of service.